This is Catherine Hastings, and you're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. My next guest is Joan Gelfand. That's G-E-L-F-A-N-D. She is a poet and a novelist. She has a novel coming out called Fear to Shred, which is set in a Silicon Valley startup. It's going to be coming out in September of 2015. She's the author of three collections of poems, A Dreamer's Guide to Cities and Streams, and Seeking Center, along with her most recent book, which she'll be reading from today, The Long Blue Room. Joan is the poetry editor for The J, which is the Jewish News Weekly coming out of San Francisco. You can check that out at jweekly.com. And welcome, Joan. It's good to have you here in Sonoma County.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So where do you live right now? Where did you drive up from?
I'm in San Francisco, west of Twin Peaks.
Oh, okay. Nice. Well, your latest collection, The Long Blue Room, was published by Benicia Literary Arts, and it's the first collection of poems that they have published. I take it this was a contest. Can you tell me something about how that worked?
Actually, no, it wasn't a contest.
Oh, okay.
Lois Requist, who is the poet laureate of Benicia, and James Stevenson, who's a Northern California author, he's written about California history, they got a grant from the city of Benicia to start a press.
Oh, great.
And they actually heard me, one of their staff or associates heard me read at an open mic. In fact, at Connie Post's open mic at Valona, and she invited me to send a manuscript.
Wonderful.
And so that's how that went.
Very good. Well, congratulations
Thank
to you.
You.
Yeah. The cover is immediately recognized as Van Gogh's painting The Bedroom. It's risky using an image like this for the cover of a book because it sets the expectations up pretty high. And the same thing with your ekphrastic poem by the same name. So why don't we just start with that poem? And, you know, we'll talk more, but let's start out with a poem right away. Let's hear The Bedroom.
The Long Blue Room, and in French, it's La Chambre à Arles. It starts with an epigraph from a letter that Van Gogh wrote to his brother. The frame, as there is no white in the picture, will be white. This by way of revenge for the enforced rest I was obliged to take. And that was written in 1888 to Theo. Vincent, your long blue room, lilac you called it, yellow spread like butter. The wicker chairs, the rough-hewn dresser, through the shutters, Provence's watery light. You were just home, minus one lobe. You wanted a respite. You painted the long blue room, not once, but three times. You had to get it right. The long blue room was your retreat from working in a fever, a peak, a flurry of rejection.
Thank you. And I want to correct myself because I said, read The Bedroom. That's the name of the painting and the name of the book and the poem is The Long Blue Room.
But it was his bedroom. It's his famous bedroom.
It was his very famous bedroom. And it's just a gorgeous cover. I'm glad you selected that. You know, it's really nice.
I selected it. And it was an interesting little story about it because my graphic designer said that this was in the public domain. And at the very last minute, literally 3 weeks before publication date, the publisher had an anxiety attack and said, I don't care if it's in the public domain. I want permission.
Yeah.
And the funniest thing, he wrote to the museum, the Van Gogh Museum in
Amsterdam.
But in fact, this painting was inspired by the second version that Van Gogh had painted that I had seen in Paris.
So he
painted it three times. So the painting is not exactly the one that got the poem going.
Well, close enough for jazz.
Totally. But I thought that was funny because people can't really tell the difference.
Right, of course.
Yeah, they're
not
very close to each other.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Well, since we're in Sonoma County, I'd like to move to your poem, Russian River Watershed. Have you spent a lot of time up here?
I have.
Great.
I have.
Well, why did you read the poem? Because I think a lot of our listeners will really relate to this one.
Russian River Watershed. Russian River floods, then trickles, burst from serpentine Mayakamas through valley haze, flows west, always west, until word spreads. Volcanic soil makes very good grapevines, sells higher than Pink Ladies, Braeburns, Gravensteins, and Taylor's Gold. Vineyards. Apple trees topple like mown weeds, their imperfect limbs ripe with rosy fruit. Meaty walnuts, apricots, plums, pears, and figs plowed under. River flow diverted. California churns tree trunks as the world clamors for Cabernet, Pinot Noir. Farmers hoe, gird for another gold rush. Vineyards. Trees pulled as fast as oil siphoned from southern deserts, as violently as veins were mined. Merlot, Chardonnay, Sauvignon Blanc replace apples' knobby arms, the shady glen. Who's to sip this pricey load? Blue-black oak-studded hills replaced by purple grapes hanging ripe. Scatter them. They matter to birds, hungry mouths.
Thank you so much. You say you've spent a lot of time up here, so I take it you have witnessed the apple orchards and the apple orchards being plowed down for grapevines. The poem really says a lot.
The poem had a very interesting trajectory because after I wrote it, you know, you're a poet, Catherine. You know, when you write something, you don't really know if it resonates or if it speaks to people. And I entered it into a contest that I saw a call for from Cave Moon Press up in Washington State. And the contest was for food poetry. Mm-hmm. So I sent this in because this is certainly about mm-hmm. food. And I got mm-hmm. into the anthology. Well, it wasn't just about food, the anthology that the publisher was doing. It was for hunger. And he called the book Broken Circles, A Gathering of Poems for Hunger. And he partnered with FeedingAmerica.com. This was maybe 5 years ago when we were in a little bit of a more of a crisis with, mm-hmm. with hunger and economic situation being very bad. And the anthology got distributed all over the country. And so the poem had a very interesting life. I was really excited about that.
Yeah. And, you know, it makes total sense that it would be about hunger. I mean, it's wonderful to have vineyards. You know, the wine industry does great up here. But we need food. We need food. And the more you see these trees coming down and the vineyards going up, you have to wonder.
Well, you know, poets, we try to do what we can.
We do. Well, it's a very nice poem. Thank you.
Thank you.
So one of the more interesting poems in the book for me is the Ferlinghetti School of Poetics. It seems to imply that Ferlinghetti may have inspired you to write poetry in the first place. Maybe a Coney Island of the mind. Tell me about your background there.
I started reading poetry in high school, as probably most people mm-hmm. do. And he was one of the very top poets at that time. And that book just was very inspiring. But mm-hmm. what happened in this poem and where this poem came from is I literally had three dreams over the course of about a year or two about Ferlinghetti.
Uh-huh.
And at first, I wrote it off. And then the second one, uh-huh. when the scene where the child appears to me, mm-hmm. I said, I might have to do something with this. Uh-huh. And so when the third one came, you'll see in the third section, Ferlinghetti appears in a movie theater. Mm-hmm. I thought, okay, I have to sit down and figure out what's going on here.
Right,
and this poem is actually being made into a little 3-minute film by a Los Angeles filmmaker who loves this poem and lived in San Francisco and just thinks, you know, we're doing all the visuals. We did the Coney Island at Santa Cruz and we did the North Beach. He came up and we did the North Beach shots and he's very excited about it. And he's a fabulous filmmaker. So I'm really, I'm going to launch it at the San Francisco Writing Conference in February.
Oh, good.
So I'll show the film there.
Has Ferlinghetti seen the poem?
You know, we cannot get in touch with Ferlinghetti no matter how we try.
Okay.
So that's been a little bit of a problem, even though we've had inroads. But he is 92 and he's kind of had it.
93 now, I
think. Oh, 93.
Yeah.
So he's kind of getting a little tired.
Okay, well, let's hear the poem.
But this is an ode to him, I would say. You know, it's one of those things that I hope will... I did send it to him, actually. Mm-hmm. So, the Ferlinghetti School of Poetics, and it starts with a quote by Edgar Allan Poe. All that we see or seem is but a dream within a dream. One, the dream within the dream within the dream. What is it, Ferlinghetti, taking star turns in my dreams, strolling in front of cars, haunting alleyways, stairways, bars, beating moth-like, flitting through San Francisco's sex-fraught avenues in North Beach, where XXX marks art and nasty commerce collide, intersect Columbus, Telegraph Hill, Jack Kerouac Way. You are fog whispering in from the sea on another sunny day. Here's a quote by Ferlinghetti. There's a breathless hush on the freeway tonight, beyond the ledges of concrete. Restaurants fall into dreams with candlelight couples. Lost Alexandria still burns. Ferlinghetti's words sink, weighted on the business end of an invisible fishing line, dredging last night's dream to the surface, gasping for air, shivering like some catfish, eyes bulging, wet lake water dripping off its scales. The knife of memory slices open that dream, finds me on haunted streets, instructing small boy. You gotta go to the Ferlinghetti School. It's totally rad and completely cool. Two, Ferlinghetti makes an appearance. Phantom audience shouts, higher, higher. Egg the poets on. After all, they're not on the wire. Higher? We spin the memory wheel until there's my father strolling through his own Coney Island. And there he is again, winning a goldfish. The clerk hands it over, fish circling in plastic bag. Big Daddy pretends it's all for the kids. He needed to win like that fish needed water. Three, the poet reconsiders. Is the skill of life just keeping on? All the gears oiled, the doors open? Even if the past keeps drowning and the knifed open dream fish still swims around. In Dream Theater, Ferlinghetti arrives. Was it the Regal, the Royal, or the Metreon? I rise to make room for he who started everything, got the wheel of poetry turning, broke open language, letters, vaporized while he drifts, haunting my dreams.
Great. Thanks so much. So you said a Coney Island of the mind really inspired you when you were in high school. Where did you grow up and where did you go to high school?
I grew up in New York City.
Uh-huh.
And that scene with my father at Coney Island really happened.
Okay, good. Good.
So
I wondered. Yeah.
We did spend our occasional Sundays at Coney Island. My father actually grew up partly in Coney Island. Mm-hmm. I hear that they're trying to make it a national historic.
Right.
I was reading about that recently. And yes. I was also reading Yoko Ono at that time, who I found very inspiring. Her book Grapefruit and E.E. Cummings and, you know, all the top ones. But it was enough to just, get me started.
Yeah. Very good. Very good. I wondered when I read the poem myself, when it came to quote my father, if there was a double meaning, like your father, and also Ferlinghetti is kind of like father of poetry, right? Of your inspiration.
That's true. That's true. Yes, it was literally my father.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you have a poem called Sex, Death, and All That Jazz, which is such a great title. There's a real musical quality in this poem with the repetitions and breaks. It evokes perhaps a one-night stand, maybe love at first sight, the fear of losing love, all kinds of things. Would you please read sex, death, and all that jazz.
Sex, death, and all that jazz. In one night, love gripped. Time was suspended, and the love was the love of the contented. Soon after, the firing squad arrived. Gunned down innocent soldiers, my heart stopped. It ached, crying out for the men and all their mothers. Sex and death are closest relatives. One lives upstairs, one lives down. The furniture is the same but different. Sex prefers overstuffed chairs in shades of red. Death digs on black, clean lines, a wooden bed. Sex and death share walls and floors, and sometimes when you're held by love, you can hear death taking the stairs one by one by one. It's a fragile coexistence, this. Sex, death, and all that jazz. Sex and death and all that jazz, it's anything but mellow. It's about the shake-up, the shake-down, the shaky boots, and more. It's about a flip-flop stomach, the flight of bees, the shock of the right fellow, the weak knees. Sex, death, and all that jazz, we never stop to realize that, like a good story, the beginning is in the end.
Thanks so much. Where did this poem come from?
This also came from a dream.
Aha.
Yes.
Do you keep a journal of your dreams?
Yes, I'm very busy with my dream life. In fact, mm-hmm. I was a co-host of a radio show. My host is now looking for a new venue, but we had she had a radio show called The D Spot, and she's a dream expert in Los Angeles. And I would join her once a month interviewing poets and artists and musicians who used dreams in their work. And so there's a whole archive of, and we had a lot of Sonoma County artists and musicians on the show.
Oh, very cool. Yeah, I hadn't heard of that.
Marty Storm, and I'll think of a few other names as we go along. But yes, that was a great way to bring artists into the whole dream world.
Yeah, good. Well, I'm going to move on to another poem called The Marriage Egg. This is a very different simile for a relationship. How is it that you came to use an egg for this poem? You can either read the poem now or after you explain that one.
I think I'll read it, okay. And then we'll talk about it.
Sounds good.
The Marriage Egg. We begin. Soft, gelatinous, a savory soup of hope. Your cloudy white divided just barely by my sunny yolk. The thinnest membrane divides translucent frames. A tender nudge sets our insides to gush. Over time, much boiling water, heat, we solidify. There are boundaries. Now, what once cracked with the slightest tap, calcified, it is our home. We live inside this marriage egg, the yolk, the white, clearly defined, inside our hard but fragile shell.
So what would you like to say about this poem?
I have a marriage that started in the middle of my life. I got married at 47 and I met my partner at 44. And, you know, so I knew quite a bit about relationships, and it just finally mm-hmm. occurred to me that when people get together, they're willing to bend and do all kinds of nice things.
And then, how that works.
And then, you know, after a certain amount of time, over time, much boiling water, heat, we solidify, we kind of come back into ourselves. Mm-hmm. And in a good marriage, you come back into yourself more fully.
Right.
You know, you grow.
Not only allowed to do that, but encouraged.
Right, encouraged to be more of yourself. And mm-hmm. so I thought that that was really beautiful. And I thought, you know, creating a home with someone is a lot of work. And it looks hard on the outside, but marriages are always fragile.
Right, right. If you don't take them for granted, you know.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, that's so, why people get these shocks, you know. The husband comes home and says, I'm out of here. Or the wife comes home and it's like, wait, where did that come from? So, you know, you have to pay attention to your significant other, I would say.
I agree. Well, it's a really interesting metaphor, the egg. I like it. So you have a poem called Three Poems About Nothing. That's an intriguing title. It's in three parts, and each part bears a subtitle with the word none, and I'm going to spell that because our listeners can't see it. So sometimes the word none is spelled N-U-N, and once it's spelled N-O-N-E. Why don't you go ahead and read it and then tell me how this poem came around?
Thank you for explaining that. I'll just also say in the third part that the nun is going to be pronounced nun, and it's a Hebrew letter. So it's three poems about none.
Aha, thank you.
So three poems about nothing. One, the nun in me. The nun in me isn't very pure, quite the opposite. This paramour is a nasty seductress shaking up decadent cocktails of vice. This nun in me isn't very nice, wandering out late, scheming, skating with an ethereal lover, a faceless man with sexy moves, her shadowy full moon accomplice. The nun in me isn't very devoted, running, plotting against every angel who seems an obvious guide, wanting, wanton, stuffed full of wine and avarice. The nun in me behaves badly. In fact, she's better on her own when there's no one to push, no fights to incite. She's not very good at marriage, to be precise. Still, the nun in me craves a warm fire, her devoted spouse, and loves her all-black kitty. She imagines her little family wildly careening like sightless bats through a long dark tunnel, flying by feeling, sensing the way home. Two, the nun in me, which is the Hebrew letter. Hebrew letters are numbers, and the inverse of the obverse is true. The Torah is duality, calligraphed black, and all of the white space too. And nun has just my number. It's 50, fruitful and vibrant, the gate of faith itself. Three, the nun in me, meaning nothing. Am I empty enough? A circle with no center? I want nothing, really, except everything, and in small doses and all at once. Is the nun in me empty enough? I've said my prayers, sat on my cushion. I've stayed alert and relaxed. Is the nun in me empty enough? Wasn't it you who told me the world was seamless, and that went for the lampshade, too? Later, you apologized, but why? Was that before or after you said you loved me once in this lifetime? Once was just enough. Am I empty enough? Yet, the everything in me become the none.
Thank you. Very interesting how this poem travels from none to nun to none, N-O-N-E. How did it happen?
I've been practicing Jewish meditation for about 15 years, and I had a very complicated but interesting and satisfying relationship with my teacher.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that this was just something I needed to say, you know, this, I guess you'd kind of call it the, what do they call it? The whore goddess dichotomy.
Yes. Yes.
That so many women and so many feminists live with,
right.
You know, and I grew up in the feminist movement. And so I've always been very proud of being a bad girl. But when I started to study meditation, I felt like I had to start to be a good girl. And so I couldn't, I became a better, you know, more of a good girl the more years I studied. So it's really just an exploration of, you know, what is that tension within us of bad girl, good girl, mm-hmm. artist, nun, you know? And I the truth is, I have both sides. I could sit in meditation for days and be perfectly happy. But I'm also like to shake things up,
Right. And it's a redefining of what a bad girl is also, right?
Thank you.
Versus, you know, what people tell us a bad girl is. What is that really? You know, I mean, there's so much. And tell me about Jewish meditation versus, say, Zen meditation. How is this different?
My teachers, one of them is Norman Fisher, who was the abbot at the San Francisco mm-hmm. Zen Center and runs Everyday Zen. And one of them was Rabbi Alan Liu. They had both lived at the Zen Center and Tassajara for many years together as two Jewish men who had met at the Iowa Writing Program because they were both aspiring novelists and uh-huh. poets. And they both did get some recognition as poets. And Norman went down the track of being a strict Zen Buddhist. And Alan, when he was about to get his robes, took a sharp turn and went to rabbinical school mm-hmm. and said, I can't do this. And so the meditation that we did was very much Zen in its orientation, mm-hmm. but we did a lot of Jewish study.
Okay, very good. That sounds really interesting.
Yeah, it's been fabulous.
And for
it's still
15
going.
Years,
yeah,
you've
it's
been
still
doing
going.
This.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Well, I want to make sure that we have time for the last poem, the ultimate poem in the book. It's called Postmortem, and it was written after, I'm assuming it was written after a writing retreat. Is that true? Okay, so she is nodding her head. So it's interesting to me because it really shows what silence can do, what can be ushered in by spending some time in silence. So would you please read Postmortem?
After 7 days stalking verbs, phrases, nouns and similes like a tourist on safari, she arrives home to the tribe. Dried out plants, the cat's bowl empty. She hauls laundry, garbage, takeout containers, combats strange smells. After a week of breathing, mountain misery, a sense of home in the wide open, she faces closed up rooms, windows locked, and a certain gym sock aroma permeating the bedroom. Did Odysseus suffer so? It tries her sense of humor as she cleans up the mess, but after scrubbing the refrigerator, tossing moldy food, she loses her cool when finally she misses her mother, who taught her how to run a tight ship, taught her how to row.
So I want to make sure that there's time for you to read a poem of your choice here, okay? I've been kind of directing the ship here for a while. Is there a poem that is particularly important to you that you'd like to have on the radio show tonight?
Well, I think this poem, Good Morning America, Where Are You? It was written at the height of the economic crisis. Good morning, America. Where are you? Now that the buck has stopped, the jig is up, the well run, dry your eyes, you're done. The party's over, the game is played, the bad boys took off with the cash. Now that the buck has stopped, where are you? What's your place? What's really on your mind? Now that the buck has stopped, did you make the right choices, sacrifice the best of times? Can you remember your kids last season? Who won? Who lost? Who's behind? Good morning, America. The drug of distraction has worn off. The cocaine high of overvalued, done, gone, goodbye. And this downturn, this turn down, this big, big disappointment, bummer, slump, might just be nature's way of cooling us off, cooling us down, all that dough rising and rising, making us feel supernatural. But you know, she's the boss. Nature had to cool off. Man, she was feeling the heat. You have lost, and I feel for you, all that hard work and faith in the street. There's a knock-knock joke in here somewhere, something along the lines of, how many investment managers does it take to screw? Or was that greed I heard knocking your knees back there?
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Once again, you've been listening to Joan Gelfand, G-E-L-F-A-N-D. Her book is The Long Blue Room. And we're going to move on to a little more poetry with Gordon Wamsley from Copenhagen in just a couple of minutes here. But first, here is Pink Martini with Andalusia. You're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 90.9 and 91.1 FM. This is Catherine Hastings. We are going to move on now to Gordon Wamsley, who is the author of three collections of poetry, all published by Salmon Poetry in Ireland, and also the author of a novel called Daisy, The Alchemical Adventures of a New Orleans Hermaphrodite. This was recorded in the Coffee Cats Cafe in Sebastopol, so we have a lot of sound and noise going on. So try not to let it bug you too much. Just sit back and be in the cafe with us. Here we go. This is Catherine Hastings, and you're listening to War Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. And right now I am standing in the Coffee Cats Cafe in Sebastopol, California, with Gordon Wamsley, who is here from all places, Copenhagen. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
So what brings you to California?
Poetry.
Yay, what else? So you're reading here tonight, and you'll be reading other places in the Bay Area?
Well, this is my last reading, and I'm looking forward to it.
I understand that you have a connection to New Orleans as well.
I do. I'm born and raised there.
So how did you
grew up there?
How did you get from New Orleans to Copenhagen?
Well, that's a long story. But like most Americans, I was looking for something.
What were you looking for?
Something.
Something. Still looking for it?
Right. And when I got to Copenhagen, and it was the quietest place I'd ever been.
Oh, it's nice for a poet.
And I thought, I can write out of this.
How long have you been there now?
About 30 years.
I guess it's home.
Yeah, it is. Well, sort of.
Yeah.
What is home? That's the question.
Right. Yeah,
but I like it, though. It's nice being in Europe as well, and it's not far from Berlin. And
you have lived in a number of places besides Copenhagen, haven't you?
Yes.
Outside of the country here?
I have. I lived in Guatemala in 1980, which was a horrible time.
Uh-huh.
And wrote my first book of poetry. It was sort of a trial by fire, really. And but generally, I've lived in Copenhagen pretty much the last 30 years.
Well, you're a Princeton graduate,
yeah,
I see. And
right.
you studied German literature, is that right, and philosophy?
I did. I started out in philosophy because I couldn't stand the idea of being in the English department. they were telling me what I should read and what I shouldn't read, and I didn't like the whole tone of it.
And who was good and who wasn't.
That's right. And I went over to the philosophy department, and they were scratching their heads and walking around in khaki pants. And I said, this is the place for me.
Good. So what turned you on to German literature specifically?
Well, I've always loved German. I heard an opera by Wagner when I was 12 years old. And ever since, I wanted to learn the language. And there was a very good department at Princeton. And I couldn't figure out what to write in philosophy as a thesis. So I switched to German. And they had these marvelous people that were so cultivated. These professors knew so much about not just literature, but art, music, and really loved things like that. And so it was a wonderful experience.
Good.
Yeah.
Well, you have a number of books here with you tonight, poetry and a new novel as well. Why don't you just spend a couple of minutes telling me about the work you have?
Well,
I know that's a really big question.
It is, but I think poetry has always been a part of me ever since I was 10 years old. I used to recite long poems to my grandparents. And it's a very southern thing, maybe. And but one of the more difficult things was to try to figure out how to find your voice. And that took some time.
Do you think we just have a voice?
No, I think that you can get deeper and deeper so that your voice is mostly honest. You go through different painful experiences, and that helps. You know, Aeschylus's quote about he leads us on the path of truth's immortal law, that wisdom is learnt by suffering it. Ah, in pain, in sleep, the pain distills, bleeding on the memory, and makes us wise against our wills. God's grace by solemn force.
And this was all recited for you. He was not reading that. Wonderful. So you have a number of books of poems, including Echoes of a River, which are poems of New Orleans and beyond, which I think this is a really beautiful book. I've had the pleasure of reading it. And tonight you're going to also be reading from your novel, Daisy.
Yes.
Tell me a little bit about Daisy.
Well, Daisy, to me, is almost a living being, you know. And it's called Daisy, The Alchemical Adventures of a New Orleans Hermaphrodite. And it's not about sexual identity. It's about someone being in between things. And she's wants to know the story. And it takes place during Hurricane Katrina, a many-layered event, and she's trying to penetrate it. At the same time that she penetrates it, she penetrates the various levels of herself. And there's poems in it and various juxtapositions that jostle the read of the mind of the reader, so that the reader has to go through these processes too. I had a lot of fun doing it because when you read, I felt freer than I would do with poetry.
Good.
So, yeah.
Well, I look forward to hearing you. So we're going to come back in a little bit here and record your reading.
Wonderful.
Okay, thanks so
Thank
much
you so
it.
Much for having me.
Uh-huh.
Thank you for coming out on a stormy night. And hopefully we won't have to bed down here. But I thought I'd read from Daisy. It's called Daisy, The Alchemical Adventures of a New Orleans Hermaphrodite. It's not about sexual identity. But Daisy is she who is in between. She's the daughter of Hermes and Aphrodite. There are many dimensions of it. And the book is constructed in sort of a kaleidoscopic way with various juxtapositions that hopefully make the book more vibrant. And I'm going to read a section. Daisy is trying to figure out what's going on in this world, as we all are. She's trying to penetrate the various layers of existence, and in so doing, penetrate her own layers. And the reader has to go through the same process to make anything of this. And at this point, she's in New Orleans, and this is, I'm just plucking something out. And this is chapter 35. The moon in New Orleans knows the river, and she knows the things of the past. And New Orleans is a city with a past few have been able to accurately assemble. For in such a city, there is a succession of what you might call false pasts. There is the literary past, romanticized and made into fool's gold by many who would have New Orleans be a city consonant with the spells she has dreamed into her people. There is the brief simulacra of flashbacks that can be seen in photographs, paintings, diaries, and film clips. These create a dream past. Illusion and his sister, Mirage, have always been part of the city's history. To induce people to settle in the malaria-prone wetness of the place, posters were created that suggested New Orleans was a tropical paradise, rich in jewels and ease. Come to Louisiana, mountains of emeralds. Ah, the dreams the inhabitants have of New Orleans. How amused she is by these. And indeed, she chuckles to herself whenever she notices them in the minds of her sons and daughters. She knows, of course, that very few take the time to create a picture of the city's past so that it actually resembles the truth and is not merely the product of imagined hopes and vanities. To picture the city as she really is demands exertion, and New Orleans knows this, and she does her best to subvert such efforts. For she is most vain. One might say that the older she gets, the more ruse she uses. Yet she knows that to really find the truth, you have to really want to find it. And she knows that hardly anyone can bear to look at the unwished truth of anything. And so there is a natural tendency among New Orleanians not to make the effort. And yet everything else is not the truth, which is a problem. The moon, however, cannot herself be fooled. She knows everything about her city, since in many ways New Orleans belongs to the moon. In other ways, she belongs to the river. Indeed, the river and the moon can be jealous of one another. And because, needless to say, New Orleans is not always faithful, problems can arise between the passion of the moon and the allure of the river. The moon sometimes sees New Orleans as an intractable daughter, but because the moon has a great sense of humor, she is able to tolerate her daughter's vanities, ridiculous dreams and whims, her desperate failures, devastating temper tantrums, and easy forgiveness. She is a city who all too easily forgives. People do the most terrible things, experience great failures and disappointment. They can always return to New Orleans. She will welcome them, invite them in, and heal them. She is all forgiving. Well, almost. There is one thing the city never seems to be able to forgive, try as she might, and that is if you fall out of love with her. She can take many things, but she can't take that. So the moon is always careful not to be tactless with her obstreperous child. She goes easy with her, and she has been able to win her love by never offending her. I'm going to read from my last three poetry collections, which have all been published in Ireland by Salmon Poetry. And I'm going to start reading from Terebinthus. As you know, the terebinth tree is frequently translated as the oak in the Bible, but it's the one that Jacob dreamed under and many other associations. To speak really right is to peel a gauze from what we see, to hear a pulse behind. It is much more like music, deeply woven, hidden among the three blue stones, between your voice and the blood's most natural cradle. Three tones, telling the sun to move its head so as not to block the light. This is a poem about a lake in Maine called Jordan Pond. And I once noticed a loon dive, and it didn't come back. And at the same time, I was in a house that felt like it would not be able to stay together somehow. But it was frailly constructed, and I combined the two and made this poem. It's called Breakings. Roots and rocks pathing a pond where the black loon dives. If she returns, it will be to break open worlds these mountains enclose. Waiting till the sun swells, filling, we cross a bridge into the moss fields. There we find only sand and night, sweeping the forest blue. Through the tiniest of windows, trees block a lighthouse sea eagles know. Light from the island no longer moves treetops or walls of this room, nor do doors close as tight as once they did close, when you swept over the trees of light, calling the diving gloom. What is born? Not seeing very far, they couldn't say the right words. Deaf to the round tones of bells, they could hear neither warning nor peals of celebration, as when love is between the tides. On flat screens of glass, the coals alluring mists and sharp noisings, parodies of the human voice pressed into tubes. Had form sounds come, they would have been too big for shriveled souls. Small ones were better, either easier to swallow or slough off, and they could be twisted into shapes, laid out in books, rolled into lines, and called poetry, though there would be nothing of poetry in them, nothing of the sea near to men's hearts, nor of footsteps sounding down earthways, echoing into the sun. In making words, they would forget the word, and so be consigned to the lesser mysteries. But that was not necessarily a bad thing. Learning would go on, tumbling here, nations, cities, standing up over there, unexpected groupings. Fools would die to be born hungering for wisdom on the ocean seam, to learn one day that each man harbors a babbler. He spends a lifetime trying to reform. And words are his rightful means. We'll move to Touchstones, A Journey Through Poems in Xenophobic Times, is the title I found. And many of my poems are inspired by the sea or something like this. I don't know why. If life is at least one great thing, it may be it is a moving through evenings and a morning of tone-filled memory in varying substances, subtle and also coarse, descending and ascending and descending, darkening and lightening, with blues and violet and summery gold and green that lays her hand on a lake of mirrors, joined sometimes or broken into shadows, dissolving sometimes into crimson, then volving again to blue that returns with us, englobing a world smack in the middle, of all the other worlds, returning once more our feet to the heavens, to what we call Earth. Bring what you can to the silvery sea in a silence most immense, with some few sounds, a stone's crunch from the wren and the hobble duck, and a sun arcing down into blood of a luminous island. Rain on the water pulls the gulls inland, and if you climb the hill to the west, you will find them resting on lured slopes. So when it rains, you are mostly alone with the hobbling duck and the wren. You bring what you can to a rage dissolved to a whispered sheen, whitening in silver, and what is above as it is as it is below, the hermetic truth split down the middle and laid on its side. It still works, the old invocation in the unseen world, in the world we now know. And whether you watch stilled memories in a river essing south, or stand by a sea where the gulls have flown to rest on an unseen hill, you bring yourself naked to the sea's reflecting, though this time there are two young doves lifting away from the kelp to the forest within. They seem to bless the man who listens across the darkness and the echoing below. He is well within the silence of the sea, with some few sounds he would know. I thought I wouldn't read this poem, but I think I will. It's called Cross, and it's an interesting poem to me. I think one of the things that fascinates me about writing is that you get thoughts writing that you would never otherwise get. And I think that's amazing. I'm not sure why that is, why you actually have to write it to get it. This one's called Cross. Perspective is part of a roundness in seeing. As planets arcing, let a sun grow warmth into everything. Or as sinking petals in the jubilation of unfolding, release their life-bound blood from lightest hands, ecstatic, dying, giving up the ghost, meaning spirit, meaning white cloud, meaning penetrating waters. Things are often other than ever we imagine them, and ecstatic is not what we imagined either. We never expected a sunken head, nor the blues enshrouding it. We expected arms crying out to an imperishable sun, never blue shadows crossing the landscapes or traveling among light-filled beings. We dream as distant. Their lives are much more near us than ever we imagined, since there are no empty spaces to wheel despair in us, but waters limpid or turgid with so much life in them, you would be astonished if you knew. Understanding involves our own most moving inmost, wandering pools of bright reflection where heart, enamored of eye and mind, embraces a path of its own inscribing, becomes hands for marking or feet to step out spirals, whorls or sea coils, condensing them to pearls for stringing, that she may sing more beautifully, more truthfully. We spend lives dissolving the swirling shells into openings our hearts can widen, touching them at the tips of fingers, releasing worlds. This third book is called Echoes of a River, Poems of New Orleans and Beyond. And much of it was inspired by Hurricane Katrina, which surprised me that I reacted so strongly to. I was in England when Katrina happened, and I felt I had to go back and read some poems. And I'm going to read a poem called Apocalypse. This was the first poem that I wrote when I heard about Katrina. I was in England. You probably know the story of Katrina and one of the canal walls that burst or was blown up or whatever happened and flooded the city entirely. New Orleans awash in broken melodies. Bucktown's levee nearly did you in, the lake bleeding in to reveal you. Thus you have become apocalyptic. For apocalypse means laying bare what was hidden. And as in any apocalypse, a mirror is held up to every single one of us. I imagine sharks coming in for the dead, or an alligator's eyes bobbing the waters of Bayou St. John. All that was hidden rising to the surface. Scrutiny from the Cotswolds to the China Sea. And what in you is brought to light may change this stumbling nation. We who were born of you always knew there was a beast sleeping heavily below. We could sometimes hear it breathing at night or sense its faint smell when the wind was wrong. We knew too, only the lake's blood could rouse it and free us from its dreaming, so that then we could be led to the intimate place of mirrors.
This is Catherine Hastings. You have been listening to Gordon Wamsley, who was visiting Sonoma County from Copenhagen in December of 2014. He's the author of the novel Daisy and three collections of poems, the latest of which is Echoes of a River, Poems of New Orleans and Beyond, published by Salmon in Ireland. Before we sign off tonight, I want to alert you to the live Word Temple Poetry Series event that will take place on Saturday, April 25th at 7 o'clock at the Sebastopol Center for the Arts. We have Paul Hoover, who will be there with the poems of Maria Baranda. The translation is called Nightmare Running on a Meadow of Absolute Light. Hoover won the 2014 Pen America Translation Fund Award from a field of 120 applicants for this translation. Quote, one of Mexico's leading poets of the generation born in the 1960s and a powerful presence in all of Latin American poetry, Baranda is best known for her sweeping and incisive long poems. Her cry is resoundingly of sea, sponge, ant, and prayer, as related in Rapture. Along with Paul Hoover presenting these poems, we have the wonderful Michael Palmer, who is the author of many books of poetry, including Madman with Broom, Selected Poems with Chinese Translations by Yuntai Huang, Oxford University Press. And many others. He has translated work from French, Russian, Portuguese, and done so much work. So please join us at the Word Temple Poetry Series on Saturday, April 25th at 7 o'clock at the Sebastopol Center for the Arts. I want to thank tonight's poets on the program, Joan Gelfand and Gordon Wamsley. I hope you enjoyed the program. If you have any questions or comments, please contact me at khastings@wordtemple.com. Thanks for listening.